sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Debbie Senzipper, author of the new book Citizen 865, The Hunt for Hitler's Soldiers in America. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Shinshinim, our Young Representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, and our Mavena on Israel, Imbal Shtivi. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. It's relatively easy to see that Christianity or Islam or Hinduism or Buddhism are religions. It's not even all that difficult to clarify the differences between, say, Roman Catholicism and Protestant Christianity. But it's far more difficult when we are asked to explain what Judaism is. Is Judaism a religion, a nationality, an ethnicity, an ethical philosophy, a worldview, a culture, or a civilization? Well, the simple answer is yes. Judaism is all of these things, and perhaps for some Jews, mixtures of some or all of them. But it's a complicated question, for Jewish identity is forged out of a combination of each of these elements and can change for many of us over the course of our lives. First, there's no doubt that Judaism is certainly a religion, probably the oldest continually practiced religion on the planet. There are certainly variations between the different streams of Judaism, Orthodoxy, Conservative, Reform, Reconstructionist, Renewal, and so on, but still, Judaism surely is a religion, and every denomination of Judaism has recognizable beliefs, liturgy, and rituals, as all religions do, and most of them are, well, similar. There's also no question that Judaism is a nationality, since Israel is the only officially Jewish country in the world, the first nation with a Jewish majority population in over 1,800 years, and Israel is the only country where being Jewish is a crucial aspect of national identity. But Judaism is also a kind of ethnicity, or more accurately, ethnicities, since Jews come from every continent except Antarctica, so far as I know. There are the typical Ashkenazic Jews of Eastern European heritage from America, Europe, Australia, South Africa. There are Sephardic Jews of North African or Spanish heritage. There are Iranian Jews of Persian Jewish ethnicity, Yemenite Jews of Arabian Jewish ethnic heritage. There are ethnic Jews from the Caucasus of Russia, truly Caucasian Jews, and there are black Jews from Ethiopia, Uganda, and Kenya, and Iraqi Jews, and Damascus, and Aleppo Jews, and Greek Jews, and Jews from India, and South America, and on and on. And for many of these Jews, ethnic Jewish identity is a big part of who they are. And certainly Judaism has serious claims to being an ethical worldview and philosophical system, a monotheistic approach to justice and morality that has helped shape all of Western civilization and the modern world. Now, Jewish culture, or really cultures, encompasses holiday celebrations, food, music, art, literature, theater, film, ritual objects, architecture, archaeology, clothing, philanthropy, and so much more. And these very Jewish cultural expressions are distinct, extraordinary, and remarkable, too. Finally, you can make a good case that all of this goes together to forge a Jewish civilization, a constantly evolving creation of the Jewish people throughout our long, complex history. So I'm always curious about the way we are defined. When I served as a rabbi in China, I discovered that Judaism is not one of only 5 recognized religions in communist China. The Jewish communities there are considered ethnic cultural groups and can't be very open about their religious expressions, although they do hold regular services and holiday observances. Now, here in America, a peculiar thing just happened. It has implications far beyond its intended purpose and raises fascinating questions about just what Judaism actually is. President Trump signed an executive order last week designed to combat anti-Semitism on college campuses by threatening to cut off federal education funds to schools that don't curb discrimination against Jewish students. But the content of the order is quite clever and a bit tricky. The executive order defines discrimination against Jewish students as a form of bias against their shared national identity, that of the Jewish nation, Israel, rather than just a form of religious discrimination. Defining Judaism as a national identity allows the U.S. Department of Education to open civil rights investigations into schools it deems not to be fostering an open climate for Jewish students. Under federal civil rights law, the Education Department doesn't have the authority to crack down on any direct form of religious discrimination, but it can fight national origin discrimination. To use this provision effectively, the new executive order defines Judaism as a national identity, but not an American national identity, an Israeli national identity. That makes it possible for the federal government to target the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Israel movement, so popular on many college campuses. The Trump administration, along with critics both left and right, have long argued that BDS is a pernicious form of anti-Semitism, akin to discrimination against racial minorities or women. I tend to agree with that. Well, critics of a tougher federal approach to BDS say the government is now infringing on the free speech rights of the movement's supporters and is favoring Jewish students over Muslim students who feel a crackdown on BDS is discriminatory. Millions of dollars of federal funding from the Education Department are at stake. At least 27 states have now passed laws to curb BDS, in part by requiring state contractors to sign pledges not to support it. Several of those laws, however, have been struck down in federal courts as a violation of the First Amendment, which guarantees freedom of speech. The president's executive order tries to achieve through administrative action what a long-stalled bill in Congress, the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, would write into the law. That bill has broad bipartisan backing in Congress, though some Democrats and some Republicans oppose it on free speech grounds. Anyway, the executive order adopts a definition of anti-Semitism from the State Department, defining one form of it as denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, and it cites opposition to Israel as an example of that. In other words, regardless of the free speech issues involved, the American executive order essentially defines Judaism as a national identity, self-determination as expressed in the nation of Israel. Okay, while many of us, maybe most of us, see Israel as an essential aspect of our Jewish identity, I doubt that most American Jews would prefer to be defined as primarily loyal to Israel, and therefore perhaps not so loyal to America. If this is an effective way of responding to the pernicious effects of the BDS movement on college campuses in the U.S., well and good, it's an executive order that'll have an effect. Many Jewish students on college campuses have been adversely impacted by the climate of anti-Israel hatred spurred by the BDS movement. It has often morphed into blatantly anti-Semitic and anti-Jewish actions taken against college kids. But there is also reason to believe that the old dual loyalty canard about American Jews will be revived by anti-Semites in other quarters. You know, I wonder, if you are Jewish and listening to Too Jewish right now, how do you see your own Jewish identity? Is it primarily based around your relationship to Israel? On another subject, we are fast approaching the wonderful Festival of Hanukkah, holiday of dedication, which arrives next Sunday night, a week from tonight, December 22nd, at sunset, for eight great crazy nights. To play us in this morning, here's the a cappella Jewish group The Maccabees and their quite fabulous version of Hanukkah, according to the musical Hamilton.
I want to give it up for our outstanding musical guest, 613, who just did a amazing performance for Michelle and I of a Hamilton remix.
It's good.
If you ever have a chance to get the mixtape, you should buy it.
I tell the tale of those before me.
I tell the tale of those before me.
And of their victory in the fight.
And of their victory in the fight.
And now our children tell the story.
And now our children tell the story.
They tell the story of the light.
They tell the story of the love.
We'll add another one each night.
A light to freedom.
They tell the story of.
How does a humble ragtag band full of boys from Yeshiva rise up to triumph against unbelievable odds in a battle our people still remember and celebrate with dreidels every year around December?
The five pious and loyal sons of Mattathias stood against bias, said you can't deny us, you disagree, try us. Our God will supply us with strength to win, and then potato lockers we will fry us.
For every day while praying was being bartered, made harder. Our ways they tried to change. Antiochus sent his guard out. Inside our boys knew not to forget what they were part of. Five brothers and their dad ready to win or die as martyrs.
Then the Greeks came and Hellenization reigned. Our people saw our future drip, dripping down the drain. They entered into the temple and the altar they profaned, left the blood stained. Our heroes got sick of the pain.
Well, the word spread around. We said, this is insane, man. We Jews cannot survive under Antiochus' reign, man. Let's fight back and send the Greeks right back from whence they came. And our bravery will win us fame. Say your name, man.
Judah Maccabee. That was the Maccabees, a Hamilton Hanukkah. Only seven more shopping days until the first night of Hanukkah. Of course, you can still shop during the 8 days that follow that first night. Our guest this morning, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Debbie Sensiper, has an extraordinary untold story of the Holocaust and its aftermath to tell us about, all of which took place, well, almost all of it, in the United States. Her new book is called Citizen 865, The Hunt for Hitler's Soldiers in America. Hear about it when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Debbie Sensiper is the author of a new book, Citizen 865, The Hunt for Hitler's Hidden Soldiers in America. She is a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. Recently named the Director of Investigative Journalism at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, has worked for the Washington Post, won major awards in print journalism, and an author of a previous book. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So where did the idea of this book come from? By the way, I have to say, although it's a nonfiction book, it reads as compellingly as any spy novel. It really is. I like the way you worked it all in. It's terrific.
That's one of the best compliments a nonfiction writer can get, so thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Yeah. So I was at a cocktail party, actually over New Year's Eve about 3 years ago, happened to be sitting next to a lawyer who worked at the U.S. Department of Justice and told me about this little-known unit deep inside the Justice Department that had spent three decades hunting Nazi perpetrators on U.S. soil. And though I had spent a decade or so at the Washington Post in Washington, I really didn't know much about this unit, and I was absolutely fascinated by their work.
I think many Jews know about, Wernher von Braun or some of the Nazis that were brought over to America afterwards and kind of secretly, we pretended they weren't Nazis so they could help with various programs, but not that many people know about the Nazi hunters within the U.S. government.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And in fact, when this unit was created in 1979 inside the Criminal Division of the Justice Department, everyone predicted the work would last for just a year or two. You know, I mean, how many people could actually be living here? They thought they'd wrap up very quickly, and the work went on for 30 years. And I remember as I was sitting at this New Year's Eve party, the first thought I had was, I could not believe there were Nazi war criminals still living on U.S. soil so many decades after the end of the war.
And yet there were, of course.
And yet there were. In fact, this the prosecutors who worked in this unit just deported successfully perhaps the last known Nazi war criminal living on U.S. soil from Queens, New York. He had been here for 50 years, quietly hiding in plain sight, so to speak, in New York. And this unit had tried unsuccessfully to deport him for 14 years, and it just happened last year. In 2018.
Almost unfathomable. You focus on a guy named Jacob or Jack Reimer, or maybe Reimer. I'm not really sure how he pronounced it. It's almost a, well, it's an incredible story. Can you explain that a bit?
Yes, absolutely. He was an ethnic German born and grew up in the Soviet Ukraine area and was actually fought for the Red Army in the early...
He was an officer in the Red Army, actually.
You got it. He led his own, led his own platoon. He was captured by the Germans, put into a Soviet POW camp, and then recruited by the very men who captured him. So the SS recruited him because he had German language skills, and they brought him to this training camp in the tiny Polish village of Trawniki, which is the subject of the book. And in this SS-run training camp, Jacob Reimer was essentially taught to kill. I mean, it was a camp, it was a school for mass murder. And that's, and the SS trained and recruited and trained 5,000 men to do the dirtiest, bloodiest jobs in occupied Poland. These Trawniki men liquidated the Jewish ghettos, participated in killing sprees, and operated the gas chambers in the death camps in occupied Poland. They essentially helped the SS murder 1.7 million Jews in fewer than 20 months. Jacob Reimer was one of the most trusted Nazi collaborators in Trawniki, and after the war, he slipped into the United States unnoticed.
It's an incredible story, and we'll pick it up when we come back in a moment with Debbie Sensiper in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 7315 North Oracle Road, just north of Ina on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us this Friday night. We have a guest cantor, Bryce Megdahl, at 7315 North Oracle Road. Shabbat evening services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Join us this Shabbat with our special guest cantor, 7315 North Oracle Road, the west side of Oracle, north of Ina. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, rich array of adult education academy courses, and our upcoming Hanukkah celebrations, all of our services, everything, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing and warmest Jewish congregation in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's toojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You are recently back from a trip which included a star turn at a conference in Montenegro, not the most likely Jewish place for a conference that I've ever heard of.
Right, and in fact, a country that many people would have difficulty locating. Okay. So just for people who have the usual American handicap in geography, it is on the eastern shores of the Adriatic Sea, just north of Albania and just south of Dubrovnik. In fact, if you leave the Dubrovnik airport and turn right, you have a 20-minute drive into town. If you turn left, you have a 20-minute drive to the border with Montenegro. And the coastal cities of Montenegro were exactly like Dubrovnik, built as Venetian trading posts when Venice had an empire. And they were fortified and there were like armed cities, but also ports for trade. So there's a lot of them on the Montenegrin coast.
By the way, they're beautiful. I've been to Kotor in Montenegro. Right. They're now kind of vacation destinations. Right.
So there's Herceg-Novi, there's Kotor, and there's Budva, where this conference was. And this conference, I may have mentioned before I left that I was going to it, but I'm not sufficiently savvy with the internet to have done all the research I should have done. And I learned quite a bit by the time I actually showed up there on October 31st. The conference is called Machar, which is Hebrew for tomorrow. This was the seventh annual such meeting. It's changed slightly over the years, but its genesis is in the life and work of a guy named Yasha Elfandari. And Yasha Elfandari was a Jew from somewhere in the former Yugoslavia, where the borders keep shifting and it's now eight new countries. But let's say, for argument's sake, that he was from Montenegro. He grew up basically believing that even if other cities in Yugoslavia, like Belgrade and Sarajevo and Zagreb, had Jewish communities, no city in Montenegro actually did, or certainly no countable Jewish community, no minyan anywhere, no synagogue, no evidence of institutions of Jewish life. So when the Six-Day War came along in 1967, he picked himself up and went to Israel and volunteered to join the armed forces. And he was a star and he spoke a lot of languages because in the Balkans, everybody does. And after the Six-Day War, he was recruited by Israeli intelligence and spent most of his adult life working for them in I don't know what capacity.
Of course.
But when he retired, he went back to his native Montenegro and decided to use the skills he had learned in a lifetime of working for intelligence services to locate lost Jews, hidden Jews, missing Jews, half Jews, whatever, not only in Montenegro, but also in the adjacent spaces of Albania to the south and Kosovo to the northeast. So over the years, he knocked on doors, literally, and found people who said, like, why should I be interested in establishing a Jewish community? I've never had one. I don't need one. There was a lot of resistance. But eventually, he created a number of people with an awareness of their Jewish identities. And the next step in this story becomes even more interesting and is what led to this conference. So maybe we'll get to that next week.
We will talk next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
We welcome Inbal Shtivi, our Shliacha on Israel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov,
Inbal. Boker Ol.
So Israel is going to have another election. That's the third in about a year. Still, we don't have a Knesset or a prime minister. We have a Knesset, but the Knesset's dissolved. Mm-hmm. And we have no elected prime minister. And what are people saying about this in Israel?
Yeah, so it is going to be a third time in a row within less than a year. Actually, it will be set probably for early March, so it will be almost really a year without a permanent government. We are now under a transition government for the past few months. What do people say? Some are happy, some are sad, as naturally.
Some of us are not surprised, some, by the
and
way.
Many of us are not surprised. Many of the Israelis are not surprised. In a way, there was always, during these past 2 months, ever since the September edition of the election, there was a notion that maybe the parties should go into a unity government.
A unity government.
A unity government that is wide, that is crossing from a very centrally located politically, from the Likud and Kehol Levan and all the other more central parties. That notion has been promoted both by the president and other forces and other voices.
And in fact, both of the prime minister candidates, you know, the ones that were given the opportunity, tried to form a unity government and
they
couldn't
did.
Do it.
But I guess that the disparities or the disagreements were too big. That's how we ended up having the third edition of the elections. So some of the Israeli public were actually for unity, saying that this must be overcome and that we should move forward and not being in a way stuck in a loop.
Right.
And it's understandable. There is no acting government for some time. It has implications. So that's one type of voice. But other voices are saying the contrary. They're saying that the public have never voted for unity. The public have voted for either Likud, blue and white, whatever. Lieberman can. There are so
many parties in Israel, of course, right?
Many parties, many candidates. Everybody's
so they're saying basically that a national unity government would be undemocratic. That's not what people
those
voted
that
for.
Oppose the unity proposition. Are saying, yes, it's not as democratic as having another election. And those that say unity say we can be stuck in this loop forever, in a way.
This is an unprecedented situation, unique situation. Israel's never been in this place before. Mm-hmm. And parliamentary democracies rarely go this long without being able to make a decision. By the way, calling something a permanent government in Israel is a little bit comical.
Rarely
do they serve out the full term. There's a new election, and that's not unusual in parliamentary democracies. Mm-hmm. But boy, it'll be fascinating to watch, because what happens when there's a third election and the same votes take place?
I cannot say. I don't know. Maybe it could be that we go over this drill over and over again. But other processes are happening. Likud is changing.
Right. They have new elections for their own leadership.
For their own leadership. There is the process with the prime minister himself that's going on. There are different processes that affect this situation.
Sure. So things may change.
So might be, may not. Let's see.
Fascinating. Thanks so much, Inbal. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A woman walks into the post office to buy stamps for her Hanukkah cards. She asks the clerk, "May I have 50 Hanukkah stamps, please?" "What denomination?" asks the clerk. And the woman answers, "Oy vey, has it come to this? Fine. Give me 8 Orthodox, 10 Conservative, and 32 Reform stamps." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. The wonderful Festival of Lights and Latkes, Hanukkah, is coming up fast, beginning a week from tonight, running for 8 wonderful nights. Al hanizim ve'al hapurkan ve'al hakvurot ve'al hachuot ve'al hamechamot she'asita rabotenu bayamim ha'em bazman hazeh. Congregation Beit Simcha celebrates its first anniversary as a synagogue and the 7th night of the Festival of Religious Freedom with the elegant We Are One event, a night to remember. Join us for a fabulous evening of delicious Hanukkah food, champagne, and wine at a spectacular home overlooking all of Tucson, Saturday, December 28th at 5 p.m. We'll celebrate Hanukkah with glowing candles, delicious latkes, songs, enjoy great entertainment, a silent auction, and much, much more. Details are on the Congregation Beit Simcha website, beitsimchatucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Don't miss this incredible evening of joy, entertainment, and friendship. We are one. welcome our Shin Shinim, Daniel Levy and Shai Friedwald, young representatives of Israel, here for the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
When you travel, you get a reception, not just because you're young people who are traveling around, and you guys are pretty well traveled for, you know, 18-year-olds, but you also experience the way people perceive Israelis who are in your age range who are traveling. How has that been? What do they think of Israelis, and what do they think about Israelis in different places?
So one special thing that you could say about Israelis, every time we travel abroad, there's no chance you won't see an Israeli. Like every time I traveled, I've always seen an Israeli. And even if they haven't spoken in Hebrew, you could look at one.
You can tell.
You can recognize an Israeli from
Israeli species.
Yeah, absolutely. And
the only thing I'll say is sometimes when I'm traveling, people think I'm Israeli. Even without wearing a kippah. Yeah. I have no idea why. I don't look Israeli, but go ahead.
Yeah. sometimes as an Israeli, I'm embarrassed to see sometimes how Israelis behave outside. I mean, they yell and they don't care about anything around them besides themselves. And, well, at one time it's nice to hear someone that,
speaking Hebrew,
yeah,
for example.
It's like seeing family outside of Israel, but sometimes it's just like, okay, I don't know them. I don't belong to them.
It's not my fault.
Yeah, exactly. I don't, yeah.
Shai, what's your experience?
I think I also connect to Danielle's, and a lot of young Israelis after high school or during high school at the end of the year, so they go to a trip to beaches in Europe, in Greece, Cyprus, all Spain. In one hand, it's fine, it's fun. Okay, going to with your friends.
It's kind of like spring break in America. Yeah, they go to Fort Lauderdale. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
The people of Fort Lauderdale don't actually like them very much. Right. They just like the money.
Yeah, so going with your friends, having a good time, enjoy your time after graduation or something. But on the other hand, I think there are more cons than pros, because during we are outside of Israel, so we afford ourselves to act like we
idiots.
Don't care of anything.
Yeah.
Okay, so we do stupid things, especially young people, because they think, hey, I'm mature now and I can do everything and anything, so I don't give a something. And you heard about
there was a terrible case
things with
recently.
a British girl and stuff, so they can afford themselves everything they want, and it's really
not,
ugly.
Not so great.
Yeah.
It's a little different when Israelis travel after the army, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is, yeah.
Well, yes and no. I mean, they also come to just take everything out. They've been through rough 2-3 years and they just want to...
They want to just go
just
and experience
because
the
they,
world.
Exactly,
yeah.
Because they know that as soon as they come back to Israel, they have to settle back in. It's actual start life after having been pushing it for years. So yes and no. So people do, and sometimes people don't come back from their trip. I mean, sometimes people...
No, that's certainly true. You find Israelis
they go to India and they just
in Fiji and India and in Thailand and, Turkey, anywhere.
And they connect with the wrong people and it doesn't end up good, but... But yes and no, but I mean, that's the one side, but the other side could just have the best time ever. They work, they travel around the world, they have their fun.
They learn about different cultures. They
exactly.
The world.
Some people realize what they want to do for the rest of their life, if there's something.
But I'll also say, they all tend to congregate together in a lot of places.
Yeah. But what amazing thing about the trip, which I find amazing, you could travel with one friend, you would travel at least with one friend or five other friends, and you would always split up with them, and you would probably find another Israeli that you haven't known at all in another city, another country, and just continue your trip with them and just switch up friends, and that's what I find really amazing.
Yeah, it's a unique Israeli network around the world of people who have just finished the IDF.
It's like a puzzle. It's just reconnect and recombine, and it's amazing.
Thanks very much, guys. We'll talk next week.
All right. Bye. See you in Europe.
And now a word of Torah. My mother passed away about 4 months ago, may she rest in peace, and I've been thinking about her legacy lately, especially as we approach Hanukkah, a holiday she loved. Growing up, my mom used to swear she had 4 only children. A positive interpretation of that is that she felt that my siblings and I were treated as though we were truly each unique. Every one of us had distinct personalities and preferences. And she and my dad had parented as though we were all equally precious to them. the less warm and fuzzy understanding would be that we were each so demanding we required the parental attention an only child would have required. Raising children, parenting styles, and the dangers of parenting poorly are an important part of the book of Genesis. By the time we reach this week's portion of Vayeshev, we've had vivid examples of the disastrous consequences that preferential parenting can cause a family. Abraham, in part because of his wife Sarah, favors his younger son Isaac over his eldest son Ishmael. The results of that rejection are still being felt around the Middle East. Isaac prefers his elder son Esau to his twin brother Jacob, but his wife Rebekah likes Jacob better. The results of their cross manipulations spell conflict and a 20-year exile for Jacob. And now, here in Vayeshev, we come to Jacob's own cataclysmically bad parenting of his large brood of 12 sons and a daughter. In particular, we get to know Joseph. You know, Joseph is one of the truly spectacular figures in the whole Bible. He's the principal character of the last four weekly portions in Genesis. His story has been called the first truly modern piece of literature. It's a great tale, only partly about failed parenting and sibling rivalry. The Joseph story begins with a bang this week. Jacob's beloved wife Rachel has died in childbirth, giving birth to the 12th and final Jacobean son, Benjamin. In a pained overcompensation for the loss of Rachel, Jacob spoils her older son Joseph, giving him a famous coat of many colors and then using him as a tattletale spy on his older, tougher brothers. The brothers' revenge is swift. They capture Joseph and sell him into slavery in Egypt, then tell their father a wild animal has killed him. After adventures demonstrating Joseph's virtue and spectacularly bad luck, this week's portion ends with Joseph in an Egyptian prison, Jacob in mourning in Canaan, and all hope seemingly lost. The eventual message of the Joseph story is that God's plan will work, but we aren't always privy to how or why. But a second message is even more important. Our children all are precious. Favoring the good one does no one any good. Treating each with love, as though in fact each of our children was truly an only child in receiving our love, is the Jewish way to parent successfully. Perhaps in good families we are all only children. Our guest this morning, Debbie Sensiper, is an outstanding journalist who's researched a long-hidden Holocaust story about bringing criminals to justice right here in America. Hear all about it when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A horrible anti-Semitic terror incident in Jersey City, New Jersey, a city of about 270,000 people just across the Hudson River from New York City, ended with a police officer and three innocent Jews murdered at a kosher market in Delhi. The two shooters, David Anderson and Francine Graham, who perpetrated the crimes, were finally killed after a furious five-hour gun battle over the streets of Jersey City. The slain officer, Detective Joseph Seals, 40 years old, led the police department in the number of illegal guns removed from streets in recent years in Jersey City, and he was investigating a homicide when he was murdered by gunfire near a cemetery. Seals was a married father of five who had been with the Jersey City Force since 2006. After murdering the detective, who worked for a unit called Ceasefire, the killers drove a stolen U-Haul rental van to the J.C. Kosher Market in Delhi a mile away, shot the three people they found inside, and when confronted by local Jersey City officers, engaged the police in a long shootout. After the shooters were killed, a live pipe bomb was found in the stolen van. The three victims in the market were Leah Minda Ferenc, 31 years old, a mother of three who owned the market with her husband, Moshe Deutsch, a 24-year-old customer and rabbinical student, and Miguel Douglas, 49 years old, who worked in the store. The Jewish market was specifically targeted by the murderers, said Jersey City Mayor Stephen Fulop. Jersey City Police Chief Michael Kelly said that when police responded, the officers were immediately engaged by high-powered rifle fire from the murderers inside the kosher store and deli. A video shot by a witness shows a police officer on the ground by a car, apparently wounded. Another officer goes to him, helps him up, and the two run around the corner as gunshots ring out. Seconds later, as a police cruiser pulls up in front of the store, a dozen shots are heard in rapid succession. Our officers were under fire for hours, said the police chief. One of the perpetrators, Anderson, published anti-Semitic and anti-police posts online, and the attack was motivated by those sentiments. We will continue to follow this awful story. In happier news, the Baseball Hall of Fame's Modern Baseball Era Committee finally opened the doors to Cooperstown to Marvin Miller, the late founder and leader of the Major League Baseball Players Association, a Jewish son of a Lower East Side salesman and a schoolteacher who took on and defeated the wealthy baseball owners. It was under Marvin Miller that major leaguers were granted free agency rather than being tied to one team, spurring enormous growth not only in their salaries but in the game. Miller, a member of the National Jewish Sports Hall of Fame, also introduced salary arbitration to baseball. The average baseball player now makes $4.36 million a season, maybe more than that after this offseason, with some contracts reaching over $400 million over their term. The owners are doing okay, too. Baseball is now an $11 billion a year industry, up hugely from what it was in the days when the reserve clause tied players to their teams for life or until they were traded. Marvin Miller, a Brooklyn native who served as union chief from 1966 to 1982, died in 2012 at the age of 95. After falling short in the expansion era committee vote for the Hall of Fame in 2011, one of seven times he didn't make it into the hall, Miller asked that his name no longer be placed under consideration, but it was. And this year, 12 of the 16 members of the Modern Baseball Era Committee, former players, veteran executives, media members, and so on, gave Miller the 75% he needed to get in. Players are pleased that Marvin Miller will now take his rightful and long overdue place in the Hall of Fame, said current MLBPA Executive Director Tony Clark, in recognition of the monumental and positive impact he had on our game and our industry. In Canada, a Jewish student leader at McGill University in Montreal is fighting efforts to oust her from the student union for accepting a trip to Israel and the Palestinian Authority. Jocelyn Wright, a member of the Student Society of McGill University's Legislative Council and Board of Directors, said she is outraged and disgusted by a Student Society call for her to resign for agreeing to a trip sponsored by Hillel. She is refusing to resign or quit the trip despite the threat of impeachment upon return. The trip is called Face to Face. It leaves at the end of the month and includes visiting Palestinian areas of the West Bank. As a Jew, my connection to Israel is one core aspect of my identity. I hope that the trip would help me experience Israel through a new lens, Wright explained. She called the effort to have her resign anti-Semitic. The SSMU president singled me out and actively encouraged others to attack me, she said, adding that a non-Jewish council member who is also going to be on the trip has not received the same treatment. In 2017, the McGill Student Society failed in an effort to impeach a Jewish counselor for being pro-Israel, and an ex-member tweeted, "Punch a Zionist." Finally, in more positive news, Natan Sharansky, the extraordinary former refusnik, Israeli political leader, past deputy prime minister of Israel, and head of the Jewish Agency, has been awarded the Genesis Prize for 2020, a $1 million monetary award for service to the Jewish people that is almost always distributed to Jewish charities, as Sharansky plans to do. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Debbie Sensper, is the author of the really terrific new book, Citizen 865, The Hunt for Hitler's Hidden Soldiers in America, an investigative journalist, professor, author, and she was recently named the director of investigative journalism at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, and a Pulitzer Prize winner. By the way, they just hand those out, you know, every day to everyone who writes, don't they?
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Right. Believe it or not, some of my colleagues at the Washington Post have more than one Pulitzer.
Unbelievable. We started to talk about the Tronicki camp, the sort of Nazi training camp for the worst murderers of all, which when you think about it, the worst murderers in the Nazi regime, that's quite a title. Tell us a little bit more about Reimer's story, the guy who's kind of the protagonist of the book in some ways.
Yeah, sure. So these men were not, the Tronicki men were not members of the SS. They were not members of the Nazi party. They were the foot soldiers, as one historian at the Justice Department called them, foot soldiers of the Third Reich. The SS didn't have the manpower to murder, you know, the Jews of Poland in the time that they wanted to get the job done. They needed help. They needed collaborators. And that's where Jacob Reimer and his men stepped in and did the work for them. So Jacob Reimer was a platoon leader in Tronicki. He was given paid vacations. He was given health benefits. He was given, you know, wages. He actually left Tronicki to visit his family a couple of times unescorted and came back on his own to continue his work. And in fact, in 1944, earned his place in Nazi Germany. After the end of the war, he was granted citizenship in Nazi Germany. So he was really a full-fledged part of the Nazi regime in Occupy Poland. Slipped into the United States, into New York after the war, and actually operated a Wise potato chip franchise in New York for years and years before retiring to Lake Carmel. And by the time he retired, he had American sons, an American wife, he had a Social Security card, he had a pension, he had become a naturalized citizen. And that's the way U.S. investigators found him when they went to try to bring him to justice.
How did they find him?
You know, they always knew of him. And they knew of him because they were bringing other men to court and other Nazi collaborators who they found his name in the records. But Jacob Reimer had always insisted that he had a very minor role at Tronicki. He was a paymaster. He served in a camp administration. He had no blood on his hands. And only after years and years of digging in the archives of Eastern Europe did U.S. investigators, specifically historians inside the Justice Department, learn that he was not a lowly paymaster, that he was actually a trusted Nazi collaborator who not only helped liquidate the Jewish ghetto in Lublin, Poland, but also helped fight alongside the Germans in Warsaw during the ghetto uprising.
You know, were some of the people that they were able to find, was that partly after the fall of the Soviet Union and when those archives became available to the West?
Yeah, you're exactly correct. So they had some information before the collapse of communism, but really when communism collapsed and investigators and historians were able to get into the archives in Moscow, in Prague, in Kiev, and in other places, it really gave this Nazi hunting unit new life. It really extended their mission for years because they were able to get access to Nazi rosters and records that no Western investigator had ever seen before. And it's one of the things that drew me to this story as an investigative reporter for so many years, the idea of getting access to documents that no one had seen, you know, looking through dusty records in the archives in a basement somewhere. You know, that's just speaking my language as an investigative reporter. So it's one of the reasons I really wanted to tell this story, not just because the prosecutors were so impressive, but the historians who worked behind the scenes for years. Just, I was fascinated by their work.
You know, we tend to think that every story has been told. Those of us who are active in the Jewish world, I cannot tell you how many books on the Holocaust have come out every single year, and every expose seems to be, well, like, how could they find anything new? But this is new.
It is, and I will admit that my Jewish mother, who has a Jewish book club, said, are you really going to write a story about the Holocaust?
Because right. It's so hard for us to find books that are not about the Holocaust to choose.
Yes.
What do we need with another book?
Yeah. But this one was, to me, very different for two reasons. One, not a lot of people in the Western world understand Tronicki, even people that read about the Holocaust, like study the Holocaust. I took Holocaust classes in college, this is a new aspect of the Nazi operation in occupied Poland. And it was really uncovered by Western investigators. So I was drawn to that. The other reason that drew me as a writer to this story is I wanted to understand how historians and prosecutors could spend day after day, year after year, digging in to some of the darkest moments of Holocaust history, reliving it by interviewing not just survivors, but killers who describe mass murder in such clinical terms. And how could these historians and prosecutors live in this dark world every day and then go home to their families, to their wives, their husbands, their children, to vacations and soccer matches and pediatricians' appointments, and have that kind of a normal life when during the day they're immersed in such darkness? So their backstories I was really interested in exploring in this book.
The story of Reimer, you know, which forms such a core of the book, the presentation initially is such a, you know, courtly man, pleasant, and he just goes and testifies about all this stuff that he did. And you think, like, how does that ever happen?
Yeah. No, it's true. He looked in court like an ordinary American, in sneakers and a sweater, and he was in his late 70s and very affable man, and quite frankly, a very likable man.
I hate to say this. I kept thinking of Mr. Rogers, you know. Seemed so banal.
Oh, sure. And stoop shoulders and just a guy that, you know.
Just a guy.
In fact, Eli Rosenbaum, who is one of potentially the longest serving Nazi hunter, I believe, on U.S. soil, who ran this unit, really thought he could be a babysitter, that Jack Reimer looked like a babysitter. And another prosecutor just said, you know, who's the killer and who's the victim here, just by looking at Reimer in the courtroom. It was a great challenge that this unit had to convince judges and in some ways the American public, that delayed justice still mattered. That it didn't matter how many years had passed, didn't matter that defendants were growing older. They had no business living here in the first place, let alone dying in peace on U.S. soil.
Where can people go to find out more about you, about your work, about the book?
Thanks for asking. So the book is for sale on Amazon, in all major bookstores, Target, Barnes & Noble. I have a website that's nice and simple. It's just debbiesensiper.com. It's my author website.
And just in case, C-E-N-Z-I-P-E-R. You got it.
There's only one.
Right. Trust me, there's only one with that last name. Still based in Washington, contributing reporter now for the investigative team at the Washington Post, where I was on staff for a decade. And working on books.
I want to thank Debbie Sensper for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Citizen 865. And if you want to get a great read, even if you if you've had enough Holocaust books, I highly recommend this one. It's really a terrific book. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Brooke Goldstein, founder and executive director of the Lawfare Project, a legal think tank and litigation fund that upholds the rights of Jewish people and the pro-Israel community worldwide. And definitely go to see the great Israeli world music singer, songwriter, guitarist David Broza at the Fox Theater this Saturday night, December 21st. You can get tickets at the Weintraub Israel Center Facebook page or email israelcenter@jfsa.org or through the Fox Theater website or box office. David Broza was our guest last week. He's fabulous. It'll be a great concert. Our play out this morning for the coming holiday of Hanukkah, starting a week from tonight, December 22nd at sunset, comes from Yosef Karduner. It's a lovely Maoz Tzur, the Jewish Rock of Ages for Hanukkah. My friends, may you have a Shavuot Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Maoz Tzur Yeshuati Lechana El Shabeach Tikon Beit Tefilati Vesham Toda Nezabeach.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.